Imagine being taught by the best professors in the world.
Hello, I'm Walter Lewin, and I am back in my beloved lecture hall, 26100.
From some of the best universities.
You're going to look at the world in a way that you never have before.
Bringing you some of the best courses.
Whether you like it or not, I'm going to make you love physics.
This is the world of MOOCs. Massive, open, online courses. A world where anyone, anywhere, can have a university education free. I'm Sarah Montague, and in the documentary this week on the BBC World Service, I'm looking at the changes in education being brought about by technology. In this second programme in the series, The Education Revolution, I'll be investigating what's happening in universities and looking in particular at the phenomenon of MOOCs. Could these new, free, online university courses open higher education up to parts of the world in a way that's been unthinkable up to now? Or are MOOCs an experiment which could destroy centuries of tradition? Let's see. Computer science from Harvard? Historical Treasures and Cultural China from Tsinghua University? Or Anatomy at Leeds? There are an awful lot of courses. I'm going to sign up for some. How the web is changing the world. That seems appropriate.
The web is transforming society.
It's changed everything we do. The way we
3 hours a week, 6 weeks, all from home on my laptop. I think I can do that. I'll let you know what I have to do and how I get on. I've come to the States because it's here that MOOCs took off. These short online courses were only dreamt up a couple of years ago, but since then, millions around the world have signed up for them. At a time when university appears increasingly unaffordable, these free courses look like the ultimate solution. At Harvard, more people signed up for MOOCs in a single year than graduated in its entire 378-year history. That's why almost every university is asking what this new way of learning might mean for them.
We're in Sanders Theatre here at Harvard, which is a gorgeous wood-paneled theatre in the round with a kind of soaring dome, and it holds just over 1,000, and this is where I teach justice.
The political philosopher Michael Sandel is one of Harvard's star professors. For the past 30 years, he's been happy filling this lecture theatre. But then his course went online.
I didn't really know what to expect. And I can say I was astonished at the reaction. I never imagined that this would go all around the world, that tens of millions of people would be watching what is, after all, a philosophy class.
And it has. I mean, it's turned you into a global superstar.
Well, that, too, is something that I couldn't possibly have imagined. So it's been very exciting, but it's also provided an opportunity, really, for me to engage students across national and cultural boundaries. Students from Brazil, from India, from China and Japan, grappling with Aristotle and Kant and John Stuart Mill. That's what excites me.
Harvard has gone for MOOCs big time. Together with the other main university in Boston, MIT, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, it set up edX, one of the largest providers of MOOCs. The man running it is Anand Agarwal, a professor of engineering and one of the first to make a MOOC.
We just announced that course online. No marketing budget. Within the first few hours, we had 10,000 students enrolled in the course. And over the next few days, the enrollments kept going up. Initially, we thought we'd get maybe a couple thousand. But the enrollments went on all the way up to 155,000 students from 163 countries. 155,000, that number is more than the total number of alumni of MIT in its 150-year history.
And this for a course in circuits and electronics. Other universities making these early MOOCs had similar experiences and couldn't believe the numbers signing up. Distance learning had always had an old-fashioned reputation, but this was different and exciting. Maybe it was the timing or the packaging. Certainly, they'd tapped into a huge public thirst. Universities responded to the demand, devising hundreds of MOOCs. And so too have commercial firms, who are packaging up lectures from universities and hoping to find a way to make money. Think of university, and this is probably the image.
leafy quadrangles, muted red brick buildings, and students discussing Keynes or Kant. They're special places with centuries of tradition. Come here to Harvard, the oldest university in America, and you feel it. How much of that history is down to these bricks and mortar? Or could it all be recreated in a virtual world?
And those both funnel into life on super Earth.
I mean, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying
Harvard's boffins are getting a makeover by its in-house production team. They're trying to work out the best way to present each course. They coach the lecturers to improve their delivery, and together with video and graphics, try to create enough razzmatazz to keep an online student hooked. They've even talked about approaching Matt Damon to see if he'll present a MOOC. Now that's one I'd sign up to. This may be Harvard, but it's a long way from traditional teaching. For that, you just need to walk into Professor Stephen Greenblatt's lesson on Shakespeare.
He says, so shall my anticipation prevent your discovery. I'll tell you what it is that's
The Pulitzer Prize winner was among a group to write to Harvard, urging it to consider the impact of MOOCs both on Harvard and the higher education system as a whole. I sat in on one of his small tutor groups. They were talking about Hamlet.
What's the meaning, Carolyn, of his saying, I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth?
He is an engaging teacher, enthusiastic about his subject, and it's clear from their conversation that he knows his students well. There's a kind of magic to these interactions that seems to go to the heart of the best teaching.
Well, he might be concealing the stuff about the murder of his... Small detail. In terms of his feelings.
That's interesting. It's crucial, really. He's in a weird situation in which he's simultaneously lying and telling the truth.
This Socratic discussion is the way people have been taught for centuries, but MOOCs have yet to find a way to recreate it online.
I hope it matters what I think about Coriolanus or I think about Hamlet, but actually, as a teacher, what really matters is what my students think about Hamlet at the end of the process of reading it, and that's something that I can foster, shape in a personal face-to-face way that is much more difficult to imagine digitally. To me, sitting down with people, talking with them, moving in directions that I might not have planned ahead of time, is part of what I think my work as a teacher is.
So, week two of my course. I'm going to check in with my professor. He, of course, doesn't know I exist, but he's becoming a bit of a fixture in my life.
So by counting retweets, we're saying that power and influence can be judged by looking at how well a person's information propagates through the network.
I've got a 10-minute video to watch, some articles to read, and then there's a multiple-choice quiz at the end of the week. I'm being encouraged to join the online discussions, and they're telling me not to feel overwhelmed by the thousands of others I'll find on the message boards. It is one of the paradoxes of MOOCs that its professors are both the most and least accessible teachers in history. It's a far cry from a Harvard tutor group. Every interaction is via computer. In fact, one of the first emails I received warned me not to try to contact any of the tutors personally. But whatever their limitations, these courses take universities to some of the remotest regions of the world. Harvard put us in contact with Claude Mukendi.
I was born in Kinshasa in Congo. I'm from a big family of 14 children, 5 girls and 9 boys.
Via Skype, he told me how he'd done well at school despite the country being at war. Then when he was 17, he moved to South Africa. And although he always dreamed of going to university, he never thought it would happen. Then one day at his computer, he came across edX. It was offering a free course.
I stumbled upon this website, and then I remember I clicked on the link and it took me to edX. I was blown away, but I was like, okay, there's a lot of scams online and maybe this is not real. I really, really thought it was a scam. Harvard University, you know, I always see them on TV and I know it's like it's only for a chosen few.
With a young son and struggling to pay the rent, he thought it sounded too good to be true.
I did a bit of a background check. I Googled edX. I wanted to know where it came from, how it was founded. And I saw phone numbers and email addresses that I tried to also Google, and I realized that it was real. And I registered for my first course, which was The Challenges of Global Poverty. It was really great. And right now I've signed up for a couple more, which I'm currently studying. Yeah. For someone like me who can't afford, you know, university fees, that's the closest I could get to a Harvard University. It was a great feeling. It really, really was.
He did the tests. That doesn't mean he gets a qualification, just a certificate saying he'd completed a short online course from Harvard. But he's using it in his hunt for a job. And that idea that someone sitting anywhere in the world can have access to the best education is central to Harvard's mission of spreading knowledge, and the reason why, together with MIT, it has put $60 million into MOOCs. But stories like Claude's are, for now, still fairly rare. When Pennsylvania University's Graduate School of Education looked at who was taking these courses, they found 80% already had a degree. It casts some doubt on how democratizing they are. Some of its early pioneers, inspired by what they saw as MOOC's power to do good in the world, have been horrified by what they describe as its hijacking at home. Mitch Denier is a sociology professor from Princeton University. He loves them and fears them, saying they could have a devastating impact on America's state universities. And this from a man who was one of the first MOOC superstars.
It was an extraordinary thing to teach sociology to students from 113 different countries at the same time. Every week we had one lecture that I had given in the studio, but we were also able to have one interactive online seminar through Google Hangout. And by using that technology, we could pick 8 students every week from places like Iran, Siberia, Nigeria, Georgia. Here, with 40,000 individuals, they would raise issues about all kinds of questions that I did not anticipate. Students learned from their fellow classmates from around the world. As a result, all kinds of groups would form of students interested in different aspects of the lecture. In the course of just the first 3 weeks, I had more responses to my sociological ideas than I had received in a lifetime of teaching.
The way you're talking, it almost sounds like it would have been a highlight of your teaching career.
This was definitely the highlight of my teaching career.
But then he says that he heard the University of Maryland were going to use his MOOC to test whether an online education was as good as a traditional one, and that they were looking at ways to cut costs. He asked them not to use his course, and he pulled out of making MOOCs, the most prominent professor to do so.
It's very clear to me that the agenda of some is to take these classes and to use them to cut back on funding for state universities. I personally really just don't want to be part of that process. But I don't want to be part of something that is going to be important in destroying the state universities.
You think that's what will happen? The MOOC movement will destroy state universities?
I just don't know whether the MOOC movement will destroy state universities, but I had quite frankly become embarrassed to be associated with a movement that increasingly was looking like it was going to be putting colleagues and future professors out of business.
The vast majority of American students, of course, don't go to the likes of Harvard and MIT. They're far more likely to be going to places like Mass Bay Community College. It's an hour's ride on the T subway west of Boston. 80% of American students in higher education go to colleges like this or other non-elite universities. And it's a very different experience. Chandrakant Panze is professor of microbiology here.
There is a tremendous amount of pressure to contain costs. The more the MOOCs get established, the more the argument is going to be persuasive that why don't we look at this? Why don't we use this? Why do we need to pay you so much money to teach psychology to 30 students if they can all be watching this MOOC video?
And some of those videos are fabulous and free. But Professor Panze believes the result will be that lecturers in community colleges become little more than glorified teaching assistants. Are you feeling the pressure from the administrators of the college and from legislators that actually MOOC should be replacing some of what you and your colleagues do?
Not yet, but I really think that it's on its way. I think there will be significant pressure from the legislators, from the college administrators, to try to use these MOOCs to cut costs.
So what do you think it'll mean in terms of jobs?
There will be far fewer people teaching psychology, for example, fewer people teaching philosophy. Mm-hmm. The problem there is, do we want all to be taught philosophy by a couple of professors so that, you know, we are all clones of either this branch or that branch? That's a very real fear. Even if these two professors are on the opposite ends of the spectrum, there are so many shades of gray in between. And the question is it good for education?
In the States, it's a question that's pitted professor against professor. In the middle of last year, the philosophy department at San Jose State University wrote a highly publicized open letter to Harvard's Michael Sandel to say professors who care about public education shouldn't create products that undermine it. It blew apart the consensus that MOOCs were universally a good thing. Professor Sandel recognizes they have a point.
I actually think that is a serious challenge and question that needs to be debated. I think they're right about that. It's not quite true that I created a product to replace anybody. I don't think of the course as a product at all. I'm not selling it, and I've said to Harvard, I don't want them to sell it. For me, the experiment is creating open access, not trying to figure out how to make money on it.
But in a way, it's that very open access that has created the problem, because you're cheaper. This fabulous course, the Justice X course at Harvard, is cheaper to deliver for San Jose University than having a professor there to deliver the lecture.
It's true that it's cheaper, and in the case of my Justice course, free. But I think it would be a terrible mistake for San Jose or any other university to think that just asking students to watch my lectures can substitute for the learning that goes on in a classroom with the sense of community of learners, teachers and students together. And I would be very troubled if my course were used in that way.
Week 4 of my MOOC, and I really have been a pretty rubbish student, a bit preoccupied by the day job. To catch up, I need to watch some more short videos and read some more articles. But in falling behind, I'm not alone. The typical dropout rate for MOOCs is 90%. If I do submit an essay along with thousands of others, who marks them all? The different MOOC providers are still working that out. Some courses are using students to peer review work. Others, like edX, are programming computers to do the work. Across the states, in California's Silicon Valley, the man who did the very first MOOC, Sebastian Thrun, is trying to work out the future for MOOCs. He was so bowled over by their potential that he left his job as a professor at Stanford to set up the for-profit MOOC company, Udacity. But then he shocked many by admitting that MOOCs were often a lousy product. He's now trying different ways to make it work. For some courses, he charges, but at a fraction of the on-campus cost. And he's also radically rethinking what a university can do for its students. He works more closely with business and has teamed up with companies in Silicon Valley, using them to devise courses for their workplaces and then matching students to the jobs available.
We have many of the key Silicon Valley employers, Google, AT&T, a whole bunch of other companies building courses with us that matches specifically what the world's leading companies want you to know. And in exchange, they get access to the top performing talent in those classes. Most of our students do projects, not exams. We love projects because it's a fantastic way to build up a portfolio. And these companies look at those portfolios and occasionally say, wow, this is better than what our own employees can do. So lots of people get hired off the spot just from their performance at Udacity.
Universities are watching Udacity closely. If the best companies start choosing to employ someone who has done a MOOC, and possibly one the company has tailored itself, then why would a young person choose an expensive campus course when its online equivalent opens the door into a job? Professor Peter Boll is the man leading Harvard's journey into the world of MOOCs. As an eminent Chinese historian, he seems an unlikely candidate for the job. But he knows the power of using technology to spread wisdom. When he put his neat way of remembering Chinese dynasties online, it went viral. Chinese students all around the world loved the combination. A renowned professor using a clever teaching device. It illustrates the potential of MOOCs.
I think that we have to really think about the problem of what we might call the last man standing. You could sometimes feel that your company, your university, your way of doing things is so good and has such stature that no one ever is going to challenge you. And I think we've seen this in lots of places. And gradually, the world changes around us, and all of a sudden, there's new kinds of competition, and you're left the last man standing, but you're going to go too. And the way I thought of this was visiting a place where they had, a number of years ago, decided that their library would be the center in which would draw in online learning, digital technologies, innovative pedagogy, that would all be gathered in the library. And it makes the library an extraordinarily vibrant place. Other places said, we have best library in the world. We don't have to change anything we do. And now all these new innovations have taken place outside of the library. And at a certain moment, you look and you say, well, why does the library need so much money? And that money goes elsewhere. And I think that's a terrible shame. We need the ways in which we learn, from books to speech to video. These are all parts of learning, and they're all parts of knowledge, and they need to be treated as part of this great enterprise that universities are engaged in. And I think that as responsible social actors, we want to and need to be part of the world that's changing around us.
MOOCs are shaking the university world. There have been some remarkable claims made of them, that nothing is more potential to lift people out of poverty, that they can solve the financial problems facing higher education, both for students and for cash-strapped universities. And from those opposed to them, that we'll end up in a world where rich kids get taught by professors and poor kids get taught by computer.
You'll start to see the web in a new way. You'll start to understand.
I've learned some fascinating things on the courses I've done, and I've enjoyed them. It's not the same as just reading Wikipedia. But it's also a world away from the fast-paced, fiery and fun discussions you have when you're learning with a group of friends on campus. A world in which the friends you made were perhaps more important than what you learned. MOOCs are changing with every new one that comes along. New things are being tried. They really are making it up as they go along. Sebastian Thrun, the man who started it all, reckons that in 50 years' time, there will only be 10 higher education institutions in the world. Even if that's overstating their effect, they are making people ask fundamental questions about what university is for. And one thing's for sure, the revolution is coming. That's all from this edition of The Documentary, with me, Sarah Montague. The producer was Adele Armstrong. To hear more from the series, go to bbcworldservice.com/thedocumentary. The